Welcome to the only show that cuts into the big issues behind the best books on politics and world affairs. I'm Derek Conway, and this week Epilogue is reviewing Letters from Palestine, edited by Kenneth Ring and Gassem Abdullah. Ring and Abdullah have published a remarkable collection of 30 personal viewpoints, both from those Palestinians living in the occupied territories and also those who've migrated to the USA. Before I introduce my studio guests, let's take a look at this brief introductory video.
From 1948 onwards, the Palestinian people had been dispossessed of their land, robbed of their homes, and made refugees in their own country. Many were forced into exile. Others stayed to face the occupiers head-on. In Gassem Abdullah and Kenneth Ring's Letters from Palestine, we gain an insight into the lives of 30 Palestinians. Some recount growing up abroad as part of the diaspora. Others discuss life under Zionist occupation in the West Bank and Gaza. Every letter offers unique perspectives on the learned and civilized people enduring with dignity and resolve, vowing never to lose their humanity despite the inhumane agenda of Israeli terrorism. Recommended by leading authors on the Palestinian struggle, Letters from Palestine is an informative and vibrant account of a nation making their stand against injustice, a people who refuse to surrender and continue to live their lives with good humor, courage, dignity, and honor. In today's epilogue, we'll be discussing Abdullah and Ring's publication, Letters from Palestine.
A collection of letters reflecting tragedy and humour aimed at persuading those who live in the United States and the West that behind the politics are real people with real hopes and fears. So to consider this book, I'm joined in the Press TV studios by John Austin, former Labour Member of Parliament and now Chairman of the Council of Arab and British Understanding, and Anna de Jong, an anthropologist and faculty member at SOAS, London University. Welcome to you both and thank you for joining us. An interesting collection, not the sort of book we usually review because it's a compilation edited by Professor Ring. What did you make of the book, John?
It's a very moving account, and I think that anybody who wants to understand what it is really like on the ground in the occupied territories needs to read a book like this. And I think it's particularly important that one of the editors and one of the people who was responsible for the book coming into being in the first place were of Jewish origin as well. And I think that's, I think we need to recognize there are many, many Jewish people who are horrified what is being done in their name by the State of Israel. And it's welcoming and refreshing from that point of view.
Yeah. Interesting collection. Anna, what did you make of it?
I completely agree. I think it's a very important book. It teaches people something beyond the news. The Palestinians have been made almost invisible through rhetoric of politics. And I think it's very important that people realize that we are talking about real lives here, and this book really shows that very well.
A lot of the contributors are people perhaps more of your age group than John and mine, so that sort of bitterness is still there, but it's more developed. I mean, there is an interesting sense of hope that comes through the book, even amongst those who are no longer living in Palestine but have found themselves to be emigres. Did that sort of find a generational link for you?
Well, I'm not sure if that's anything to do with generation, but it is something that I find in Palestine. Mm-hmm. I find it remarkable that people, despite terrible surroundings and terrible things happening to them, stay positive. And many, especially in Dip's book, The Voices Come Forward, of non-violence. And I think it's more than courageous that people who, most of them lost family members, people in prison, lost their houses, remain steadfast, how they call it, sumud. And teach the world about their will to live.
Yeah. I don't know whether you find it, John, but I suppose a lot of the images you see, particularly in sort of mainstream British or American media of Palestinians, it's always, you know, people throwing bricks or bottles. It's a violent image that's always portrayed, yet one of the things that comes through in this book is that sense of the peace activists that Anna's mentioned.
Well, I've always been astonished how passive the Palestinians have been in adversity.
Yeah.
But I think what you're saying is highlighted in the beginning, where there's the experience in the United States, where one of the contributors is talking to an American about the situation of Palestinians, and their image of Palestinians and Arabs, which they get day by day by day in the media. I was also reading recently a book called Bad News from Israel, which is by, not by a political activist, but by the professor of communications at Glasgow University, who was looking about the way in which language is used to distort images in the media, in the press. Mm. I mean, for example, the Palestinians always attack. The Israelis only ever retaliate. You never have a Palestinian retaliation. Sure. It's always they who are seen and portrayed in the media as the perpetrators, whereas in fact they are the victims of the occupation, of the displacement, of 60 years of oppression and denial of their rights.
I mean, I suppose some of there is a feeling of anger in some of the essays, not all of them. But I mean, I thought the one by Abdullah, one of the sort of co-editor, minor co-editor in the book, but where he's saying he and his wife, as a Swiss national, had lived in Gaza for, or Ramallah rather, for 12 years, and then the Israelis changed the, you know, the foreigners weren't allowed, and she had a fortnight's notice to get out, and it was a sort of irritant that clearly was very angry. It made him quite angry at the time, and why wouldn't it? I mean, so sort of niggly things that you think, why do that, just to upset people? It's...
Well, I think to answer the question why it happens, in West Bank and Gaza, the people are not wanted. They're not wanted. They don't want to be included. The Israeli state doesn't want to include them, but they do want to include the land. You have bombings, nightly raids, imprisonment, but also small bureaucratic rules that are almost impossible to know. And if you know them, they would change. These are part of an occupation where you control an entire population.
I suppose, I mean, one of the contributors describes being detained at Tel Aviv airport because he refused to pay a new departure tax that was specifically there to fund the Israeli Defense Forces. And unfortunately for the bureaucrats at the airport, he's a highly educated, highly articulate man returning to America. And I thought it was interesting how he describes the sort of hitting bureaucracy hard. But because he was articulate and intelligent enough to argue his corner, eventually they sort of backed down. But you could sense the frustration and the anger coming through that he was being treated as very much a second-class citizen.
All of the incidents in there, at the checkpoints of the identity papers, the daily humiliation of the Palestinian people, the very moving story of the pregnant woman who has a Palestinian West Bank ID card,
yeah,
and deciding, you know, where is she going to deliver? What does the permit allow her to do? Is it time limited? Where can she have the baby?
Sure.
People are denied medical treatment because they can't cross the checkpoint. All of these, and this is day by day. Going to school is accessing clinics, checkpoint, papers, daily humiliation, but people take 5 hours to do a 20-minute journey.
Yeah. I suppose after so many years now, many people have just come to not necessarily accept, but I mean, human beings, and you'll know this as an anthropologist, do have a way of adapting to the most distressing circumstances. But I was surprised at really how calm many of the contributors are in the book about this sort of the daily hampering of their lives, that rather than being really frustrated about it, they accept this is just what we've got to come to terms with.
Well, I don't think they accept it and they want to come,
sure,
to terms with it, but they do realize that there's nothing else they can do except struggle in this manner. You have to remember that in the West Bank, if you would stand up and shout, or if that's all you want to do at a checkpoint, that's fine, but you won't get through the checkpoint. You won't be able to go to work. You won't be able to provide for your family or go to school.
Sure.
Israel would just say, okay, don't. Or in worst cases, imprison you, or unfortunately also seriously injure people.
Yeah. I mean, I think one of the positive things that comes out of the book, where clearly there are expressions of anger and distress and the things you'd expect, is this almost in every essay, how important education is to the families, often where they're living in absolute penury, often living in complete hovels in a refugee camp, and yet it's important that the children get an education, girls as well, not just the male children. And I think a lot of people who don't really look at Palestine in any kind of detail would be quite surprised by that.
I think you're right, and I mean, whether you meet Palestinians in the diaspora or you meet them in the West Bank or in Gaza, there is this thirst for education, and the Palestinians, despite all the adversity, are probably one of the best read and best educated of any of the Arab nations. Yeah.
I think the literacy rate is well into the 90s. I mean, it's compared to most nations, it's extraordinarily high that they place such a... Maybe it's because material assets have been so restricted over so many years that education's the one thing that occupiers can't take away from you. Maybe that's what motivates them.
Absolutely, and it's also a part of what they perceive to be their Palestinian identity. They say, I will not be made into a terrorist. Mm-hmm. Despite the whole world thinking that we are A or B or C, we are actually staying who we are, and we are a people who is hospitable to other people. We make food, we welcome people into our house, and we educate our children. And unlike what Israel tries to portray, they educate their children in universities and school, and not the hate propaganda that a lot of people want to see. And I think this book is very important because it educates us. It's very, very sad that the Western world, America, Europe, Australia, etc., has to be taught that Palestinians are human. Is it maybe not a time that we ask our questions? Why do we not realize that? It's a very sad thing that we apparently don't see them as humans.
But I think one of the letters is from a young girl who's gained an education in the West Bank and then gains clearly very, very bright, a Fulbright scholarship, which are not given away. You have to be really quite bright to gain that, to go to an American university on this full scholarship. But to get permission to take it, she has to get to the American embassy in Tel Aviv, and the Israelis make it virtually impossible for her to do that. So she loses that scholarship. And you think the Americans might have found some way of getting around that by now, but they don't appear to have, which is really just sort of cutting off opportunities for young people to actually take advantage of scholarships, which surprised me. Had you come across this before?
Well, I mean, it comes over in one or two places in the book. I mean, there's the one the student who eventually ends up at Imperial College in London, but loses out on the opportunity to go to the United States, eventually gets another scholarship to come here. And by the time they've got their permit, the university has to bend the rules here because they passed the limit for coming here.
But sure.
There was, you know, they could have lost that point place as well.
Yeah. So. It certainly now looks at. One of the things I'd like us to take a look at, an extract from a book, because I think about halfway through the book, there's an interesting essay from a young girl who watches her mother being shot by Israeli soldiers. Her mother was a tremendously popular peace campaigner, unarmed, on the front doorstep of a home. So let's just take a look at this passage and how the daughter comes to terms with that.
The meaning of Shahadin in Arabic is a young gazelle that is now strong enough to walk independently next to her mother. Despite the treacherous bullets, I can see her running freely and happily across the green fields of Palestine, asking us to join her in a cosmic celebration against hate and bigotry, and telling us that this land shall be soon the home of peace and justice for all.
So although there's immense sadness in that extract because she's watched her mother being killed, she's watched her father being wounded, worlds falling apart, there's actually a lot of hope expressed in that essay as well, because she's visiting her mother as a gazelle whose, you know, image goes on. And that, I think that's an interesting essay because of that. Rather than being bitter and twisted and wanting to get a gun or a bomb, she actually has taken a completely different route and become a peace activist and sees as quite a hopeful message. Do you think that's a remarkable thing, or is that the way hopefully more and more people would react?
Well, I hope it is. I mean, I think it is a remarkable thing. I don't know what I would do in those circumstances. I think if I suffered the kind of maybe I wouldn't be brave enough to be a terrorist, but you know, I could not think of myself not reacting in an angry way. Sure. To the kind of treatment. But what you see coming through here is that letter after letter says if we react in that way, they will have beaten us.
Yes.
And it's that resilience too that we're going to preserve. I think you said earlier on the dignity. We're not going to be forced into indignity by the
situation. It's quite interesting, Anna, that your sort of generation now in Palestine and those who've had to make a life abroad but still, you know, hope to return to their ancestral home, that there is this element of hope that comes through so many of the essays, rather than this is something that's never going to happen. I mean, they certainly haven't accepted defeat by any measure, have they?
Absolutely. They have not, and they will not, not ever, I think, give up until there is justice. I would like to say, though, that it's not about will more people do this. This is already there. This is on the ground. Every week there are demonstrations. Another day goes by that there isn't a talk or an information evening. There is a huge grassroots non-violent movement in Palestine right now. Newspapers here ask, where is the Palestinian Gandhi? Well, he's there. Where are the reporters to cover those people? And in addition, what is not covered in the news here enough, according to me, is that a lot of Jewish Israeli people join the Palestinians in their struggle for human rights. In our perspective, or in the Western perspective, a lot of people think that you either are pro-Israeli or pro-Palestinian. While these people themselves, they say, no, you're either pro-human rights or you believe that it's okay to differentiate between people based on ethnicity alone.
Yeah. John, I probably know you for about 25 years now, and when you were first banging the drum about people should take more interest in what's happening in Palestine, there weren't many people prepared to listen. But do you feel that's changing now, that particularly politicians and maybe journalists in the media, as Anna says, are now looking at behind the stories a little bit more?
Well, I think there's been a shift in view, and I think that's because of the enormity of some of the Israeli actions, particularly the bombing of Gaza, and that has changed the perception somewhat. I mean, yes, to speak up 30, 35 years ago for the Palestinians, you were instantly labelled anti-Semitic.
Yeah.
And certainly the one thing you could never do was question the wisdom of the creation of the State of Israel. I'm not sure you can do that very easily now. But to try, I think there is a wider understanding of the real issue of occupation. But still, I think there's a distorted view in the press. The media, the way the media use language, does not give a true picture. And I think that's why this book is so refreshing. This is not politicians speaking. This is people of all generations, humble farmers, children trying to get an education, doing their normal everyday lives with all the same concerns and cares that you or I have about their family, about their mother, about their children, about their sister, just trying to live a normal life in very abnormal circumstances.
Yes, I mean, none of these people want to be heroes, do they? They want to get on with their lives, really. They want to, you know, live a normal family life. They don't necessarily want to be exceptional, yet they are forced to be exceptional. I think, I don't know whether you found it, Anna, but I thought the letters from the people who were in their early 20s were particularly hope-giving, because these are probably the grandchildren now of those who went through the early struggles, and yet their generation is probably better at getting them message out around the world because of the impact of the internet and media. I mean, do you think that will increase in pace in terms of understanding of a younger generation of the issues?
Yes, I'm slightly hopeful in that respect, in the sense that more and more people get themselves educated. They read books like this and watch documentaries and learn what the occupation means on the ground rather than the rhetorics of politics. I think the BDS movement, the people following the Palestinian call to boycott Israeli products and goods, is gaining wider understanding. Unfortunately, though, it's an understanding among average people. The politicians may or may not agree, understand, learn, but it's not reflected in any policies towards Israel.
Yeah. I mean, you find in British politics, John, that the new leader of your party, the Labour Party, and David Cameron, probably not a paper between them on how they stand on Israel and Palestinian issues. But, I mean, do you see a change coming, maybe even American-led, where they're never going to desert Israel, and you know, that would be unrealistic to expect, but maybe they're going to become a little more a critical friend?
I've not seen much evidence, I have to say, on the American side. I think there is a growing confidence among American Arab citizens to speak out, and that may be the beginnings of a change. But I think you're right that there has to be a change in the United States attitude in order for the conflict to be resolved. I have to say that I'm not particularly optimistic at the present time. It's the electoral cycle is the problem. That American presidents make brave words, but then they're into midterm elections and then they're into re-election. You know, if they're going to do something, they're going to have to do it in year one. And the other problem is, in my view, is the Israeli electoral system. I think until the Israeli electoral system changes, it's not going to throw up a leader in Israel who's going to be able to do a deal and deliver something.
And part of Professor King's motivation in this book, Anna, was to try and... It's aimed at the American audience, if you like, or a Western audience. It's not aimed at Palestinians or people who are pro the Palestinian cause. It's aimed at trying to get people to see behind the stone-throwing and the bombing and the anger, to try and see the sort of hope and the real-life existence of people behind. Do you think this is going to cut any ice? Do you think the American media, the British media, will give it any kind of a hearing?
I think... Well, it's hard to say whether the media will give attention to it, but it will find its way among the people in other ways. And I think it's especially because it's a Jewish writer. Unfortunately, we have to have Jewish people convincing the world that it's okay to stand up for the rights of non-Jewish people. But that is an important part of it. And I think in America, more and more Jews who say, this is not happening in my name. And it's very sad that we cannot accept the same message from an Arab, for example, or a Palestinian or anyone else. It needs to be a Jewish Israeli. In Israel as well, it's the peace activists there who stand with the Palestinians are brutally broken down by their own government. They're imprisoned if they refuse to go to the army. They are tear gassed, they're bombed as well. And I think it's important to support these people, both Palestinians and Israeli people who do not agree with occupation and say human rights should apply to all. It's a message that we had many, many times in many generations. And I guess Israel and Palestine is a human rights struggle of ours.
Well, I suppose one of the things that comes out of this book is that two of the contributors are Christian Palestinians. So it's not about Islam versus Judaism at all. It's about land, isn't it? But I'm afraid that's all we've got time for. I found Letters from Palestine a moving insight into the lives of ordinary people caught up in an extraordinary conflict. Their humanity and humour will hopefully give policymakers pause for thought about the true impact of power block broking. I'd like to thank Anna and John for joining us, and I hope you've enjoyed the show. If you have a book you'd like the programme to review, we'd like you to keep getting in touch, and here's how.
The Epilogue team want you to continue with your book review suggestions. You can email us at epilogue@presstv.co.uk. And don't forget to join our Facebook page. Enter Epilogue on Press TV into the search bar. You can watch past episodes, extended interviews, leave comments, and take part in discussions with other Epilogue fans.
Keep your feedback coming, and until next time, thanks for watching.